Coming up on Boston Public Radio, court proceedings with high stakes abound in Massachusetts. We'll discuss them all, Tsarnaev, Bulger, and Hernandez, with attorney Harry Mannion. Carl Hart used and sold drugs as a kid. Now he's a professor at Columbia, saying the war on drugs is the wrong war. He'll tell us which is the right one and the winning one.
Then editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGorry, joins us to talk Whitey Bulger and the end of the legendary waterfront restaurant Anthony's Pier 4. Then, a possible way to escape student debt plus, do not miss this, another possible way to feel happier about your spending. All that on Boston Public Radio 89.7 coming up. Marjorie Egan, you're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Big day today in town, Jim.
We are drowning in courtroom drama here in Massachusetts.
Yes, so we are.
First, there's Bulger, obviously the latest being the trading of F-bombs yesterday between former allies turned, I guess you'd say, rat on rat. Then ex-Patriot star Aaron Hernandez with a load of new information released in Florida and Attleboro in the last 24 hours. And today, as you all know, accused bomber 19-year-old Jahar Tsarnaev faces his first day in court. Here to discuss all three matters with us is attorney Harry Mannion. He's the founding partner of Cooley Mannion Jones. Harry, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, great, Jim. Marjorie, nice to be with you.
Hi, Harry. So, excuse me, as Jim just said, everybody knows it's going to be a big rush down at the federal courthouse today. Tsarnaev, the younger brother, of course, surviving brother, faces his victims and their families for the first time. What's going to happen? This is an arraignment. So
right. We
list the 30 charges. Is that what happens?
Right. Yeah, I mean, the law says that you read into them, but the defendant almost always waives the reading of the arraignment. It's 70 pages, Marjorie, and it's quite a narrative. So you waive the reading of the arraignment, and the court makes it clear that what the charges are without going through page by page. And, we'll say is there, since these are penalty carry, 17 of the 30 charges carry the death penalty. Everyone's aware of this. So there's really no question of bail. You have to go through the motions, but Tsarnaev's going to be held without bail. And they'll get a date for the first status conference, and it'll be on its way. The government will be then obligated to produce its information. It gathered in the investigation on a sort of a rolling basis. What do you have now that needs to be produced under federal criminal discovery rules? And when you get new information, you disclose that, and they will set a schedule. And there will be a pretrial conference at some point, and there will be a trial at some point. And when is that, Marjorie?
Excuse me.
I have no idea.
Harry,
what the docket's going to be.
Harry, why will there be a trial? Can he not plead guilty?
He could. It's very difficult to plead guilty. I mean, first of all, it's going to be up to Attorney General Holder to decide whether the government's going to seek the death penalty.
Yeah.
And whether that's negotiated, Marjorie, I don't. You know, they certainly brought in a death penalty negotiator lawyer onto the defense team, and she has a reputation for negotiating down certain, pretty clear capital crimes. This statute, I'm sure you, Jim, and you both know that has the death penalty of this particular means of mass destruction, using a means of mass destruction, a weapon of mass destruction that causes death, has only resulted in two or three capital punishments. Timothy McVeigh being the number best example of it.
Yep.
So it's rare that there is capital punishment in America. And remember, after Tsarnaev goes through this, he then faces a murder charge in Middlesex County for the shooting, the homicide and the death of
Sean Collier.
Of the MIT, Officer Collier of MIT.
Harry, you say, Eric Holder, I mean, I'm glad you made the point. It is not the U.S. attorney, it's not Carmen Ortiz who decides if the federal government will seek the death penalty. It's the U.S. attorney himself. What is Holder? I mean, Holder personally, this is what I find so odd about this. Holder personally is opposed to the death penalty. He made that clear in his hearings, his confirmation hearings. But what's his record on seeking the death penalty in potentially a capital federal cases over the last, 4.5 years?
I don't know of any example, Jim, where he has actually pursued it. I can tell you from the DOJ, my knowledge of the DOJ's internal procedures, there are two or three levels of review and recommendation before it gets to Holder. And so Carmen Ortiz, whom I know very well, has sent it up to Washington, and it's being the evidence, the indictment, everything they have is being reviewed at two levels at least, and it may be even three, before it gets to the Attorney General's desk with a final recommendation whether to seek or not to seek. And there are all kinds of factors besides the evidence and obviously the consequences, but they'll take into account Tsarnaev's, the younger brother, what was his role actually? Did he set down the bomb? It looks like he did. Did he do it knowingly? It looks like he did. For what reason did he do it? Was he somehow brainwashed by his older brother, extraneous forces, his age, his experience?
Does it matter that he has no record? I almost feel ridiculous considering the crimes for which he's accused to even say that. Is it relevant to consider the fact that he's 19 years old and has no criminal record?
Yes, they will. Jim, I know it seems completely illogical, but yes, I mean, had he done three or four other major crimes, and this, you know, that he was, right. You know, he had a long history of bombing and somehow was out and then did this, it would really augur for capital punishment. But no, this looks like his first, and it's so massive, and the consequences are so devastating. And it's going to be a tough call. I wouldn't handicap how it's going to come out, but you made a very, very apt point on the predilection of our Attorney General and whether that shakes and bakes into I'm gonna seek the death penalty in the first instance and then plead down to natural life, enroll Matt Middlesex into that too and shoot him over there and have him plead there, saving, you know, a lot of agony.
Okay.
You know, I'm not talking about expense. I'm talking about living through the awful lead up to it,
sure.
And the consequences afterwards.
We're talking with Harry Mannion about the case of Zohar Tsarnaev, who, of course, is going to be arraigned this afternoon down at the waterfront of the United States District Court. So the deal is he could plead down, once the death penalty thing is decided, he could plead guilty to everything else, get a life in prison kind of a sentence, and that's the end of it. There's no trial. That's possible,
and
correct?
That, Marjorie, is probably his best outcome.
And then, but the victims would still have an opportunity to get up and do their victim impact
sure.
statement before the sentence. Okay.
At sentencing, Marjorie, you'd have the victim impact statement, both at Middlesex Superior from the Collier family and everyone who's been hurt by the loss, directly hurt by the loss of Officer Collier. Mm-hmm. And then all the victims of the bombing are all welcome to be heard and will have the right to be heard under the sentencing guidelines,
okay.
But the judge will hear them all.
And by the way, if people don't know, Judy Clark, the attorney that's helping Tsarnaev, also helped Jared Loughner, the shooter in the Gabby Giffords case, and the Unabomber, and Susan Smith, who rolled her two little boys into a lake in South Carolina.
Did you go to the trial?
I did. I actually covered that trial. That was a long time ago. So, Harry Mannion, what's possible defense? I know you talked about his youth and inexperience and lack of record. If there is a trial, what's the defense?
Defense, Marjorie, is that he was so under the sway of his older brother and other external influences that he was so far brainwashed that he did not have the mental capability of forming the premeditated malice aforethought intent, which is the absolute cornerstone of murder, both with respect to Collier and with the use of a weapon of mass destruction. He lacked the ability to appreciate the criminality of his action. Now, given some of his statements, including the one that was found in the boat, and his statements that he was doing this for, you know, some sort of misguided religious purposes or whatever, that's going to be a tough sell. And you know, 99.9% of the time, that does not hunt. I can't think of what else you can say.
Yeah.
The evidence is overwhelming.
Yeah.
You see this through. You don't see it in Whitey Bulger, but Hernandez and Tsarnaev, you see, the day of technology has sort of is taken over in our criminal justice system. You know, Margie, you go. I know you're very young, but you go back years
where
you were newer, you covered cases back in the day where, you know, it's documents. And maybe you get a tape recording, but you don't have video of no, all this.
Harry, do you know that she rode a horse and buggy to South Carolina for the Susan Smith case?
I know she's a lot younger than I am, Jim.
Hey, Harry Mannion, let's move on to the Hernandez thing. Obviously a big day. Documents released in Massachusetts, in Attleboro, North Attleboro, wherever it is, Bristol County, and also down in Florida. Let's do Attleboro first. I hate to use the word smoking gun, and it's so trite and inappropriate here, but I just did, so it's too late. It seems to me the only thing that comes out of this is the dramatic scene at the door where before Hernandez purportedly, according to the police, slams the door in their face when they tell him it's a death investigation. The most dramatic part is that he never asks who's death. What are you talking about? And just shuts the door and that's the end of it. Beyond that, what do we come away with that is either damning or exculpatory or anything out of yesterday?
Well, I think the most significant besides that point, and I think his demeanor and then his statement to the police are inculpatory. I think that they show some sort of reasonably read to show some sort of consciousness of guilt, although I don't put a lot of weight on it because the forensics and the video is so overwhelming. I think that Ortiz's statement that Wallace told him that Hernandez told Wallace that the two guys with him, Ortiz and Wallace from Connecticut, that Hernandez confessed to shooting him. He said, I did the shooting to Wallace, who reports that to Ortiz. Now, you guys...
We should be clear, by the way. That's the Florida affidavit.
Right.
There was a pile of 150 pages that came out of Bristol County, and then this Florida thing, this affidavit from Carlos Ortiz, one of the three guys allegedly involved in this thing. I'm sorry to interrupt you. So continue the thought.
That's good clarification. Yeah. First of all, people will say who have covered cases, well, that's hearsay. Well, it is. It's not hearsay from Hernandez to Wallace. That is an admission by the defendant. But it's probably accepted into evidence because this is a joint venture. They came up here. They got in the car. They were armed. They picked him up, no question. There's a video. Another thing, Jim, that came out from the affidavits is a video showing the victim getting into the Altima, into Hernandez's car. That corroborates the victim's sister, who was an eyewitness to that. So he was in the car. And so the affidavit indicates that you have that piece of video, you have the demeanor, and then you have this so-called... Now, here's the problem with that, and this raised a question with me. The state's theory right now is that the two guys were called up by Hernandez to take care to do something with Lloyd. They went and got him. They drove him to a mile from the house, and he was shot five times. Now, all four of them were in the car. I don't know. I mean, Ortiz appears to be distancing himself from the shooting. I'm going to guess Wallace is trying to distance
himself from the shooting. Of course, of course.
And I said on day two, I said the day he was arrested on the air, I said the only possible defense Hernandez has, in my opinion, is I wasn't the shooter. Here's what I did. I went down. I got these two guys. I wanted to scare this guy, not because I was worried about anything he was saying about, you know, some double murder that I had nothing to do with, but he was abusive to my fiance's sister, and he was acting up. So I said, "Let's scare him." And these two guys got carried away, and they had words with Lloyd, and they shot him.
And I
tried to cover it up. That's his best case.
Right, and his contention would be there. Not only did I not shoot him, but since it was really their idea, I had no intention. Then there's no joint venture, so I'm not responsible on that level. But I have to say, you know, the Associated Press story, which is fairly typical, uses language, editorial language in their story, says the revelations provide, this is the Ortiz thing, saying that Hernandez told Wallace I did the shooting. The revelations provide the most damning evidence yet. I have to say, I don't buy this. I mean, to continue your thought, what is Ortiz going to say? Oh, by the way, I'm the one who shot him. And not only is that, so is it not powerful to me? What makes it even more ridiculous, if people are suggesting, as I and I think you and I'm sure Marjorie is, that, you know, the fact that Hernandez didn't ask at the door who died, who was killed, is something. How about the fact that apparently when two people got back in the car, unless I misread this evidence, two people got back in the car and Odin Lloyd didn't. Did Ortiz say, what happened to Odin Lloyd? And then he waits 24 hours to hear from Wallace about what Hernandez did? It's ridiculous.
It's worse than that, Jim. It's worse than that. This revelation is not good for the, and I've seen that a lot of people think this is some sort of smoking gun. It's the opposite. It creates credibility issues and possible reasonable doubt in a participant, because I don't believe that. I had to go relieve myself, and oh my God, what happened? Who believes that? Ortiz is hurting his credibility as he scampers to distance himself. And whether Wallace is talking or not, we don't know. Ortiz is clearly talking. I mean, there's no question. We know that from he's given statements to the police, and his dangerousness hearing was continued from yesterday to the 14th of August. And dangerousness hearings, which you hold without bail, which allows the government to hold you without state, to hold you without bail, they move on a very expedited basis. So his lawyer went along with that continuance, and he's in jail without bail, without anything. So that usually happens when you've got someone who's cooperating. But I think it was a step back. And if you're going to defend Hernandez, that's what you're going to be looking for. You're going to try to make this into a credibility crapshoot between my guy,
yes,
the football player, and these two bad guys that he involved, and then they got carried away on a frolic.
And all you have to do is raise it to the level of reasonable doubt. You don't have to prove
it. Also, Harry Mannion.
He won't walk, but he could maybe knock it down to murder, too. And let me tell you something. It's a biggie. Because natural life, he gets hooked on that, murder one. He does natural life, no parole. That's 60 years on his life expectancy behind the wall. 15 years parole eligibility, murder two. That is a big difference.
And you know something, Harry Mannion, since we both have been around for a while, we all know that when these joint venture cases come to the courtroom and the jury doesn't really know who the shooter is, they're loath to convict, someone they're not really sure, especially if this guy, Ortiz, is that his name?
Ortiz, the guy from Florida.
Pleads down to a second degree already, and the jury knows that one guy pleads to second degree. He's going to get out in 15 years. Why are we going to give Hernandez? We're not really sure if he shot him. Why are we going to give him life?
Or Marjorie even less. I mean, there's no guarantee he's going to cop to 15. He may cop to an accessory before, accessory after.
Yep.
Which is 7 years, because that's our obstruction in Massachusetts. Accessory after is the same as obstruction. It's 7 years.
Okay, let's move Harry Mannion to the third leg of the murdering tripod. I mean, this is what a day and week. This is unbelievable. Bill Berger, here's my thesis on this one, Harry, and since you were kind to me on my thesis on Hernandez, I'm hoping for the same here.
Okay.
I think this F-bomb exchange yesterday and what went with it between Kevin Weeks and Bill Bulger will have as much, if not more, impact on the jury's ultimate decision than the evidence itself. What do you think? I mean, it basically says what kind of people these people are.
I think it's too strong, Jim, but I think there's a kernel of truth in your supposition, because that's unvarnished, unrehearsed, unpracticed, unlawyered. That's natural emotion. And what happens in a courtroom? I've tried 75 jury cases, maybe 80, and they watch, the jury watches everything. They watch how you behave in the hallway. And they're told not to. Everything's the evidence comes from the witness stand, but that's just not true. They watch everything, and this exchange is probative and relevant. The bottom line, though, is so what? This is just a dance, and as I said earlier, I'm a close friend and a former classmate and close colleague to Jay Carney.
Oh, you are.
I have tremendous respect for him. He's a very zealous advocate. But when you sit there and listen to day after day after day after day of testimony and implicating your client into just a laundry list of crimes, there can't be any hope that Whitey Bulger ever escaped. He'll never be out a day. So what are we really, he's 83 years old, what are we really doing here? I think we're trying to have some sort of justice for the whole thing that happened over the last 25 years. Connolly, the FBI, everything. And I think this is sort of a cathartic use of the justice system to sort of get it all out, get it done, get him sentenced, and get him to go away.
Yeah, well, interestingly, all that's coming from the defense and not the prosecution. I would say they've been tougher on the FBI coming from Jay Carney. But I'm dying to ask you, Harry Mannion, about Jay Carney. I would guess that he doesn't want to put Whitey Bulger on the stand because of this sort of behavior we saw yesterday. But maybe if it's nothing to lose, put him on the stand, because the supposition is Whitey wants.
The defendant makes that call, and in Whitey Bulger's case, he's going to make the call, not Jay. Jay can only recommend if he's. It's Mr. Bulger's absolute right to testify in his own defense. And all you can do from a strategic standpoint is inform him of his right to not testify under the Fifth Amendment, tell him what he's going to go through in terms of about a three-week grueling cross-examination. But I think Mr. Bulger is going to make that decision, not Mr. Carney.
But, but on that note, while I think there is practically no one alive who does not want to hear Whitey Bulger take the stand, what I thought was pretty significant, particularly for you who has a Jay Carney relationship, leading up to the opening arguments, all we heard all the time is Mr. Bulger. Whitey Bulger wants an opportunity to make clear that he was not in cooperation with the FBI and that he didn't kill women. But yet in his opening statement, Jay Carney never said you're going to hear from Whitey Bulger himself. And isn't that generally the behavior of a defense attorney who more than likely doesn't intend to call that his client because he doesn't want to promise something to the jury that he then doesn't deliver?
I'm uniquely qualified to answer this, Jim, because Jay and I have done cases for the judges of Superior Court of Massachusetts Judges Seminar for 10 to 15 years in which he and I have debated the strategy of this in front of students and judges for 10 to 15 years. You're absolutely right. You do not promise something you cannot deliver. And when push came to shove, Jay Carney pulled the escape hatch and didn't make that promise. He wanted to see how it unfolded. I thought he was going to make the promise at the opening because Jay is fully capable of doing that. And it's against all defense, these kind of like principles that have come up over the years. But Jay Carney is a very bold person, and I would not have been surprised to see it. Mr. Bulger is going to tell you from his own mouth and from that witness stand under oath that he did this. That he did shake down bookmakers, that he did do this, that he did do that, but he did not kill those two young women. So-and-so did. But he didn't. And so I think it's a reasonable supposition to conclude that we may never hear from Mr. Bulger under oath.
Hey, Harry Mannion,
I want to... in the air right now.
Harry Mannion, we're about to give you an A for your performance, and you have a chance to get an A+, depending on your answer to this question.
Oh, listen to
Marjorie
you.
Marjorie and I are appalled every single day we talk about the federal court cases, now Tsarnaev, Bulger day after day, that there are no cameras in these courtrooms. Where are you on this whole issue? And everybody knows federal courts, the answer is no. State courts, in virtually all circumstances, the answer is yes. Where, as a trial attorney, where do you fall on this, Harry?
I'm in favor of cameras everywhere in the courtrooms in America.
Hey.
Justice belongs to the people, and they shouldn't just make the reporter's job harder. As you guys know, having covered this, there's a lot of strictures on us when we're trying the case of what we can say and what we can't say. So it's just a game of cat and mouse with the media, and you get rid of all that if you just put the camera in the courtroom and let the public. These are the people's courts. And I'm fully in favor, and I think we should, and I think we will have cameras in the courts in the not too distant future.
I want you to know you've just won the Jim and Marjorie Barr Award for 2013. Harry Mannion, we really appreciate your time. We hope to talk to you again soon.
Anytime for you guys.
Thank you very much, Harry Mannion, for being with us. Okay, so is the war of drugs a relic of the 1980s? Up next, we'll talk to neuroscientist Dr. Carl Hart, who says, yes, it is. The war we should be waging is one on poverty. That conversation is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
The trial of George Zimmerman, the man who shot and killed the unarmed teenager Trayvon Martin, has captivated the attention of much of the country. As the trial wraps up, we'll take an in-depth look at the proceedings and the provocative debates the trial has sparked across the country. That's next time on Tell Me More from NPR News.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
We love our contributors. That means you. And the Boston Speaker Series, presented by Lesley University, featuring a prime minister, a Pulitzer Prize winner, a humorist, and a former spy. More info at bostonspeakerseries.org. Media support from WGBH and Dedham Savings. And Leahy Health, committed to providing leading-edge care right in your community, helping you become and stay healthy all through your life. You can learn more at LeahyHealth.org. That's LeahyHealth.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan.
Despite our budget problems, to the extent money can help in meeting the problem of dangerous drugs, it will be available. This is one area where we cannot have budget cuts, because we must wage what I have called total war against public enemy number one in the United States, the problem of dangerous drugs.
That, of course, is the voice of President Richard Nixon declaring the war on drugs back in the early 1970s. But 40 years on, are drugs public enemy number one, or is it something else? Here with us to answer the question is Carl Hart. He's a professor of psychology at Columbia University and a drug researcher. He's also the author of High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey of Self-Discovery that challenges everything you know about drugs and society. Carl Hart, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. You know, I'm so happy to talk to you, and I'm so glad you wrote this book, Dr. Hart, because your theory that it's not the drugs that are so addictive, it's the misery and the poverty and the despair and being trapped and all that that make drugs such an irresistible diversion. I think you are so right. So how did you get to that place?
Well, I've been studying drugs for about 23 years, and so and I grew up in a neighborhood in which people said was infested by drugs, and that was the main problem with that neighborhood. And so I bought right in. I believe that was the case, and so I started to study drugs from an academic perspective. I thought I'd get a PhD in neuroscience and study what effect drugs had on the brain and why people were addicted to drugs and why these things were so horrible. But 23 years later, I have come to the conclusion that we have been misled as a country. Some of the assumptions that we make about drugs are just false. I mean, for example, I thought that the majority of users of drugs like methamphetamine, heroin, crack cocaine, I thought the majority of those people were addicted, when in fact only a small percentage of those people are addicted. Only about 10 to 20% are addicted, and 80, 90% of the users of those drugs have jobs. They're responsible, those sorts of things. I thought that these drugs were causing people to be cognitively impaired and all of this neuronal damage that I thought was true. When I looked at the evidence more closely, I discovered that we have been misled.
Hey, Carl Hart, tell us what alternative reinforcers are, a term I never heard of till a couple of days ago, and why is it relevant to your conclusions?
Yeah, that's one of the assumptions that I learned was not false. For example, I believe, like much of the population, that people who are addicted to crack cocaine, they are motivated primarily and by another hit of the drug. That's the only thing that motivates those people. Well, I looked at animal literature, and then if you give an animal an opportunity to self-administer cocaine through an IV catheter, they too will self-administer cocaine to death. I saw this in the literature. I read about this. But when I looked at the literature more carefully, what I saw was that if you provided the animals with alternatives like a sexually receptive mate rather than having this animal isolated in a cage, if you provide this animal with some sweet treat, something sweet water, some palatable treat, they will choose these treats and not the drug. So I thought, what would happen if you did the same experiment with crack addicts? Would you see if you provide these crack addicts with alternatives to taking the drug? So you bring folks into the lab. Of course, you pass all the ethical requirements. You give them an opportunity to take crack cocaine or one of these alternatives. The alternative could be some amount of money. It could be some merchandise voucher. It can be a number of things. But when you do that, you find that crack addicts' behaviors are just like the rest of us. If you increase the impact of the alternative reinforcer, increase the amount of money, the amount of good, they won't choose crack cocaine. They'll choose these other things. And so that provided some powerful evidence that, wait a second, I've been misled. I thought that crack was so powerful, the only thing that these people respond to is more crack.
You know, it's unbelievable. When I'm reading about this, by the way, I am stunned by these outcomes with these alternative reinforcers with the human animal you talked about. And you write about the fact, just as you said, if you offer a small amount of money, let's say $5, or crack cocaine or meth, it's about a 50-50 proposition. But when you up the ante to $20, essentially everybody takes the cash. It can't be much more convincing than that, can it?
No, that's exactly right. And so I was shocked with these findings. And then when I looked at the literature even more carefully, turns out a number of other researchers had already reported this sort of stuff. But it's just not as sexy as some other things. And so it just gets washed out with noise.
We're talking with neuroscientist Dr. Carl Hart, who says that the war we should be waging is not one on drugs, but on poverty. You probably saw this, Dr. Hart. I remember reading this about 10, 15 years ago. Some guy, kind of a yuppie guy, white guy in Atlantic Magazine, wrote about going into a tough neighborhood and to look at, you know, addiction. And he talked, when he's in the tough neighborhood, he's thinking to himself, you know, it's not the crack that's so addictive. It's the thought that, say you're a single mom, you got three kids, you got no hope, you got no education, you're never going to get out of there, your life is pretty dismal, and 50 yards away from you is someone who can sell you for $5 a hit of crack cocaine so you can be out of your misery for an hour. It's a very attractive alternative. I mean, and that was a long time ago, and yet we still don't seem to be readjusting our approach to drug abuse.
Well, we don't readjust our approach in part because we have caricaturized what crack cocaine users look like. We have made them out to be these images that are just inconsistent with all human behavior. Anyone, if you don't provide alternatives to anyone,
yeah,
I assure you that they will take the only thing that's available, no matter who you are.
Hey, Carl Hart, you mentioned that you grew up in a pretty tough neighborhood. You're a Miami kid, from what I recall, from your work. You didn't just write about this experience in the abstract. You lived this experience using drugs, selling drugs. Tell us a little bit about yourself as a kid in Miami, Carl.
Yeah, one of the questions that people ask quite regularly about me is, how do you go from a deprived neighborhood like me in Miami, limited educational skills, to becoming the first African-American tenured scientist at Columbia?
The first African-American tenured scientist at Columbia?
That's right.
And you're not very old. You're in your 40s, right?
That's right.
Gee, that's not a very good record for Columbia.
But in any case, that's a topic for another day. But go ahead. What's the answer to the question, Carl Hart?
So people ask that question. And so one of the things that I have come away with the book, doing this book, is when I look at my situation, I am more resolved, more clear that there are things that we can do in the society to help move people in those situations along. One of the things that was helpful for me, for example, I was deeply invested in high school athletics. In order to play high school athletics, I played basketball throughout my high school, you had to maintain a certain GPA, a 2.0. It's not that high, but what it did was it allowed me to graduate because I knew if I wanted to stay on the team, I had to maintain this GPA. That's one thing. I had five sisters who acted as surrogate mothers, a grandmother who was really tough, and they all made sure that I stayed as close to the on the straight path as possible, even though I did my fair share of petty crimes and those sorts of things. But still, I knew I couldn't let them down too much. Another thing was that we had something when I was coming up. Federal government supported a program for poor kids like me in the summer where if you're 14 and older, you can get summer jobs. You stay off the streets. You get some pocket change. It was a great program. There was aid to families with dependent children, welfare as we once knew it. We were on welfare my entire childhood, and my seven siblings, all of us, are now taxpaying citizens. What happened with those kind of programs is that it was politically expedient to vilify the people who were receiving those any funds from those programs because of some abuses by some aberrant individuals. But the majority of us are paying taxes. And so when you remove all of these kinds of things out of the environment for people, well, the results are predictable.
So Carl Hart, assuming your research is as powerful as it appears to us as non-scientists, let's assume you could administer sodium pentothal to the top anti-drug leaders in this country, in the government. You present your research. What do they say to you under the influence of that drug as to why they don't embrace your approach? I assume the only answer is it's cheaper not to win the so-called war on drugs the way we're doing it than it is to potentially win it Carl Hart's way. It costs big bucks. Is that the answer?
Well, you're close. Just let's think about, we have to think about who has a vested interest in keeping the same strategy that we're doing.
Who does?
We have to think about law enforcement. They have a big interest because they receive, each year we spend $26 billion on the war on drugs, and they receive nearly 70% of that for law enforcement. It's a lot of money, and so it's a lot of jobs. So people are very interested, very invested. The treatment providers. The fact is, the majority of people who use these drugs don't need treatment. But yet, if you're going to have this frame, your frame is either you go to jail or you have treatment. So the treatment providers stand to benefit from this approach. Let's think about politicians. If drugs are the problem, then I have the solution for my constituents. And I don't have to search anymore. I don't need to develop some sort of programs to help people get skills. I don't have to worry about jobs. I can just point to how evil drugs are. Let's think about researchers who do the kind of work that I do. When the country says that these drugs are so horrible, how about if we get researchers involved in this? Now the researchers have a stake in this drug hysteria game. So you have all of these domains or entities who have this vested interest in keeping the same approach that we have now. Now, I want to make clear to your listeners that the goal here is not to say that people should use illegal drugs, because that's not the goal. I have young children. I want to keep them off of drugs. I want to keep them safe, more importantly. But the goal here is that I like the country to have an adult conversation about this important issue and not the adolescent conversation we've been having.
We're talking with Dr. Carl Hart, who's talking about poverty being a root cause of why people are using illegal drugs. But you also make a great point, which is very important, about the whole snorting cocaine versus smoking cocaine. The sentences are much tougher if you're smoking it than if you're snorting it. And that means that many more young black men are in jail.
Yeah. So in the mid-1980s, one of the things that what happens in a society whenever there's a new drug that's introduced to the society, incredible things can be said about that drug and believed because there are so few people in the society who's ever used that drug.
Right.
And so we're susceptible to believing all these incredible things. That happened with crack cocaine in the mid-1980s. Crack cocaine, that form of cocaine, we weren't that familiar with it. And so these incredible things were said. And as a result, Congress, a number of people had to act. And their actions were, the legislation that was passed was, we made crack cocaine 100 times, the punishment for crack cocaine, 100 times more harsh than the punishment for powder cocaine. And what we discovered was that the people who were prosecuted under these laws, 85% or more were black, even though black people don't use crack cocaine at rates more than white folks. And so those kinds of things are deeply troubling, so troubling that presidential candidate Barack Obama said that when he became president, that disparity would be gone. It's not gone. It was decreased. It's now 18-1, the differential treatment.
18-1.
I know it's really a joke. Particularly, it's a joke for someone who studies pharmacology and knows that the drugs are essentially the same.
Okay, so Barack Obama, the very same Barack Obama, has an epiphany tomorrow, Carl Hart. And he says enough of what I'll call the anti-drug industrial complex that Carl Hart says is the obstacle to doing the right thing. He says to you, you tell me three things to do, Carl Hart, to change the focus here, to really fix the problem, and I'm going to implement them. What are the three things?
First thing that I would ask the president to do is to decriminalize all drugs. Now, people confuse decriminalization with legalization. Legalization is what we're doing with alcohol. If you're 21 years and older, you can purchase it, and you can also sell the drug without fear of criminal prosecution. That's legalization. Decriminalization, it remains illegal to sell the drug. The same penalties apply. However, possession of these drugs no longer results into a criminal record. Instead, you get what is the equivalent of a traffic violation.
By the way, this is exactly what the voters adopted for a possession of less than an ounce of marijuana in Massachusetts on the ballot a couple of years ago. So people listening to us know about this.
Precisely. We've done it in a number of states with marijuana. I'm arguing that we need to do it with all drugs. That's one.
What's two?
Two would be the next thing we need to do is increase the amount of realistic education surrounding drugs. All of these commercials that we've heard, like this is your brain on drugs and that sort of thing, that's not education. That is propaganda. We have to get rid of the propaganda. We need to increase, have more realistic education. And realistic education looks like this. When we think about take a drug like methamphetamine, for example, the major concern that I have about drugs like a drug like methamphetamine is that it keeps people awake. And sleep is an important biological function. If you have chronic sleep loss, you can have that's associated with various physical illnesses like cancer, various psychological illnesses like psychosis and those sorts of things. So you want to make sure people, if they're taking methamphetamine, they're getting the proper amount of sleep. That's what education will look like. Don't take this drug near bedtime. That's one. And if you have cardiovascular problems, if you're older, we know the number one killer in the United States is heart disease. So if you have cardiac issues, don't take methamphetamine because it will increase the likelihood of you getting in trouble cardiovascularly. That's what realistic education would look like with methamphetamine. Let's take heroin. Realistic education with heroin. The major concern with heroin is overdose, for example. Overdose, however, is much more likely with heroin when you combine it with another sedative like alcohol. In fact, 75% of the deaths that occur from heroin happens because the drug was combined with something like alcohol. So public health education for that drug would look like this. If you're going to use heroin or another opiate, please do not combine it with a sedative. That message alone will keep so many people safe.
And what's three, Carl Hart?
Three would be we would have to make sure that we understand that skills, jobs, responsibilities, those are the things that we need to make sure everybody in the society has. A certain amount of education level, and jobs, those are the main things. If people have jobs, responsibilities, they're busy doing those things rather than getting in trouble, and they're busy paying taxes, contributing to the tax base. That's where the focus should be.
And by the way, in the last 24 hours, Mayor Menino, who is in his last term here, his last year here, has gone out of his way every year to implement the third part of what you're talking about. I think he announced just yesterday that he, let's put it this way, convinced is the euphemism, businesses in town to provide 10,000 summer jobs.
And
to
it's
teens,
July 10th
which is,
already.
Yeah, but that's a pretty big deal. Hey, Carl Hart, we really appreciate your time and good luck with the book. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. He's absolutely right.
Is right. But the question with everything, the question is, how do you go from what we've been doing for decades and decades with no success to something that requires a little courage?
You keep talking about the hysteria around drugs, which I think I've been talking about for quite some time now.
No, I agree with you.
Anyway, if you do not have.
Let's just say the name of his book one more time if we can. Carl Hart's book is High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey of Self-Discovery. The challenge is everything you know about drugs and society. Sorry, Margaret.
You may have noticed this. Lots of people don't have landlines anymore. Some people just get by on their cell phones, although it would be harder to talk to people on the radio if they didn't have a landline. I think that Dr. Hart did. I think Harry Mania did. But we're going to talk about the disappearance of landlines, how they're becoming a thing of the past, up next on 89.7 Boston Public Radio.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. I came up with this list this morning. The Edsel, the LP, the typewriter, Filene's basement, all no more. Well, as Marjorie said, soon apparently to be no more is the landline, as Verizon, AT&T, and all the others prepare for a phase-out. So for the next few minutes at 877-301-8970, we're going to wax nostalgic, or maybe not, with you about the landline. Do you still have one? If you do, why? And if you don't, do you miss it? I have to say, you know, I was thinking about this morning after I read the story about this is a lot of the homes on the Jersey Shore because of Hurricane Sandy are being rebuilt. Verizon does not want to replace, like, washed out these copper lines and cables because they're too expensive. They want people to go wireless. Apparently, only roughly by the end of the year, they're projecting that roughly only 25% of homes will have landlines. The interesting thing about this to me is I mourn the loss of things like Filene's basement. Even the typewriter, I have warm feelings for.
You do?
I have the notion that we would be without landlines, except for people who need it, like for pacemakers and things.
He can't work his pacemaker.
But other than people like him, is there even one little piece of you that says, God, I wish I could use my landline to dial into the Jim and Marjorie show or to call your sister?
Yes.
There is?
Yes.
Why?
What do we tell every person who's going to be a guest on this show?
Well, I'm not talking about just let's not be as narrow as people are calling.
Well, the same reason we want people to use landlines to call the show so
clarity.
That you can hear them is the same reason you want a landline at home. How many times do you talk to people on the phone and they're on their cell phone and you're on your landline and every third word is, what'd you say?
Do you have
what'd
a landline?
Say? What'd you say? Yes, I do.
Why do you have a landline?
I love my landline.
Because you're a pacemaker? No, really. Why do you have a landline?
Because, you know, I'm not going to buy. Because the reception is better in my house.
When was the last time you
landline.
Used your landline?
I use my landline all the time.
Do you really use it?
I do. And also, what do you do if the electricity goes out? You can't charge your cell phone.
Well, hopefully your cell phone is charged. You go out to the car otherwise. 877-301-8970. By the way, the reason I have a landline is only one reason, which is this is Alice in Wonderlandian with a lot of companies. If you have a package of like internet, TV, and phone, if you say, call them up and say, I'd like not to have the phone anymore, how much money will I save when I'm only using two of your three services? What's the answer?
Your rate goes up $50 a month.
Exactly. It's unbelievable. 877-301-8970. There's not even a question. The landline is on the way out. I assume they're going to find alternatives for things like people have medical conditions that they need, like this pacemaker guy, I think in New Jersey. It is in New Jersey. This 85-year-old guy. That's obviously, they're going to find some alternative. But it's clear that whether it's, I'd say, the end of this decade, the landline will go the way. Have you ever
seen it?
When was the last time you saw a telephone booth?
Telephone booths are all gone.
They're gone.
They're mostly gone. Sometimes you see them in the mall. They're not really booths. So there's little banks of telephones. But you know what's the terrible thing about the landline being gone is you have no idea. It's bad enough trying to keep track of what your children are doing when they're teenagers. The landline, we used to have some idea who these shady characters were calling the house. Now you have no idea because the shady characters are bypassing you and going directly to the kid. They're up in their room doing whatever they're doing. Even if you have them in the middle of the living room, you have no idea who's calling
these people. So there should be a parent's lobby
think that the landline I am attached to my landline. I do not want to give it up. In fact, my sister still has one of the rotary phones.
She does not. Is
yes,
that true?
She does.
Now, she has it because she's stuck in the past or because she loves
the
idea of the rotary.
This is the last rotary phone in America. We should hold on to it. Maybe in a few years we'll be able to sell it on eBay. Make a lot of money.
877-301-8970. I am not mourning the passing of the landline. Marjorie says she is.
Jim.
And what?
Don't be so quick to get rid of the landline.
By the way, I'm not in a position of authority.
Radio. We need to be able to hear people, Jim. And you can't hear
95% of the people who call us, what are they calling on?
On cell phones.
I understand that.
And 50% of them, you have to say, I'm sorry, I can't hear what you're saying. It's a bad connection.
Well, I'm not interested in talking to those people anyway. So 877-301-8970. The beauty of that, by the way, it's a great excuse to get rid of somebody, even if it turns out the sound is perfect.
That's right.
I'm sorry, we can't hear you.
You know what?
What's that?
Jim doesn't really mean that when he says, I'm sorry.
It's a bad connection.
He doesn't like what you're saying. You're disagreeing with this point.
Get out of here.
Maybe you're pointing out an error he has made. He really doesn't want to hear that.
Steve, of course we don't. Steve and Fitchburg, you're first with Jim and Marjorie as we talk about the end of the landline in America. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Jim and Marjorie. How are you doing?
Excellent.
Yeah. Basically, I keep it for the utilities that connect to it at the house and also the central alarm and security system.
That's a good reason.
I've been told that to change the hardware will be very expensive for me.
But ultimately, Steve, I'm not saying – right now, the article makes clear and some other research we did today makes clear as well. A lot of the things like you're talking about are still tied to a landline. But clearly, there is going to be an affordable alternative. So other than the utility, I guess, issue, the fact that you need it to get to accomplish your security goals and your alarm goals and whatever it is, other than that, you could live without it happily, right?
Well, absolutely. I mean, all the voice data is done by cell phones now. And it's been that way for a couple of years. So I rue the day that I have to pay $50 to Verizon every month for this, you know, this archaic form.
Are you on a landline or a cell phone now, Steve?
I'm on a cell phone.
I'm sorry, we can't hear you, Steve. No, go on.
Sounds great.
All right. But don't gotta go.
Hey, Steve, thanks. We appreciate it. Gotta go.
But don't they say
call us
when Armageddon comes, and it could be any day now,
that
the only thing that's going to survive are the cockroaches and the landlines?
No, they don't say that,
Marjorie. Yes, they do.
Who said that?
Because there's no electricity, Jim. That's not,
wait a second.
When you're Hurricane Bob, I remember Hurricane Bob. I was down the Cape during Hurricane Bob.
I remember
and everything
that.
Went,
I was too, by the way.
That's right. What worked during Hurricane Bob?
Do we have cell phones during Hurricane Bob?
Phone.
Excuse me. Did you have cell phones during Hurricane Bob?
I don't remember.
How do you charge your cell phone, Bob? I'm serious about this.
You plug it in.
50% of my charging happens in my car. Do you charge yours in your car?
You might not be able to go to Armageddon in your car. Your car might be under a tree or something.
So let me just understand this before we go back to the calls. It is anticipation of
coming.
Armageddon.
That's right.
Powerful. It's a shame the Globe reporter didn't call you before they, or Associated Press reporter before they did
that's
the story.
That's right. Let's go to Rico in South Boston. How are you, Rico?
Hey, Rico.
I'm good. How are you?
Fine.
I am calling from a cell phone, but I wish I wasn't. I miss, actually, a proper home phone. I miss the ring. Mostly.
Yeah.
And I missed that, as Marjorie, as you just mentioned earlier, that we used to have to share the phone. You know, we had 15 minutes when I was a kid.
Yep.
And I think that that idea that the parents and the whole family, well, we had less private communication. I think we're just addicted to private communication, private devices. And, you know, so not only was it a shared a home phone as opposed to a personal device, which some people probably prefer, but you could always hear it. Your cell phone, you might leave it in the other room. The volume's low. You have no idea. You're looking for it half the day.
That's right.
You always knew when that phone was ringing, and you always knew where it was.
You know, calling it the home phone, as you did, you really expressed that actually beautifully, Rico. You really did. But by the way, I assume you know that one of the thousands of rings that are an option on most of our cell phones, I know it doesn't allay your other concerns, you can make it sound like a traditional landline. Do you know that?
You certainly can, and you can even buy old landline headsets that plug into your phone if you want to walk down the front street with one of those. It doesn't really.
No, I know. I can tell in your voice. Rico, that was a great call. Thank you.
It was a great call, and Rico made a great point.
What did he say?
How much of your life do you spend looking for your cell phone? I'm
overwhelmed.
Actually,
that's a very good point.
The glasses, the keys, the wallet, the cell phone. I spend half my life looking for things.
Let me ask you. I think you would agree, though, that compared to the average American, you spend a disproportionately higher share of your. I'm not quarreling.
I don't think that's true, Jim.
Well, I think that's quite true.
Okay.
Let's go to Ray.
Ray in Dartmouth. Hi, Ray.
How are you doing today?
Excellent. Thank you.
Good. I think two things. You got two different types of landlines. You have fiber optic landlines and you have hard copper landlines.
Yep.
And I have both of these in my home. The only phone that worked during the blizzard and during last year's hurricane was my hard copper business line.
Uh-huh.
So when we wanted to make telephone calls out of the house, the fiber optic Fios line was dead, but my business line, because it's hard copper running on 47 volts, still works.
So you're making the Marjorie Armageddon argument, correct, Ray?
Well, I would never give up my hard. I'm always being solicited by Fios to go Fios business, and I would never do it because I would lose my contactivity with my hard copper line from my business.
Well, Ray, you said it well. Thank you so much for the call. He's essentially affirming your position.
Well, he's not the only one. We just got an email from Ted who said when he worked for the Red Cross, we reminded people they needed landlines for emergency preparations and response because everything else wasn't working. The cell phone is underwater. The electricity is gone. You know, service dies. I mean, look at what happened during the marathon when they shut off everybody's cell phone. If you were down there close to the marathon the day it happened,
what's the alternative? That if you're a someone watching the race, you have a landline.
Don't you realize what was happening? People were saying, "Can I go in your house and use your telephone?"
How many people were doing that?
Lots of people.
They were?
Yes, because they were marathon runners.
Freezing. Oh, you mean those who were finished and were stopped a mile before the
exactly.
finish line? Well, I agree with that.
In emergency situations,
got
Jim,
it.
Like
okay.
Armageddon.
Okay, Amanda, you're in Sutton. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Thank you for the call. Hi.
Hi guys.
Hi. Oops. Whoa, do we have two on?
No, it's just me. I've got my radio off.
Hi, Amanda. Nice talk to you. Go ahead.
Hi.
I think we do have two. We have two people on the line here. Amanda, is this you?
I'm Amanda in Northborough.
Oh, we have two Amandas. We have one in Sutton and one in Northborough.
Wow.
Amanda Sutton, are you on the phone too?
I am.
Well, you can say hello to each other. Go ahead.
Hi, Amanda.
Hi there.
Okay, so let's start with Amanda and Sutton. Tell your story to Amanda from Northborough. Go ahead, Amanda.
Okay, so not only do we have a landline, we have a corded telephone as opposed to a cordless telephone.
God. Love it.
And we do not get cell phone reception in our house. I don't know if you know where Sutton is. It's sort of in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, we do.
We literally have no cell phone reception in the house, so in the winter, we would have to stand outside in the freezing cold if we wanted to make a phone call.
Now, Amanda from Northborough, do you find Amanda from Sutton's argument powerful and persuasive?
Definitely. I hadn't even thought about that, but she's right. We don't get cell phone reception in our house either, and we have to stand out in the road.
No, do not.
I do, and to get good reception, and I've done it before, but... Yeah, I also I have a cell phone, but it's only pay-as-you-go because the biggest thing, and I can add to the conversation on this end of wanting to keep landlines, is that I don't like the culture around cell phones, which is that if you have a cell phone and people call you, they expect you to be available, and I know that I can set the boundary and not be available if I don't want to be, but I've had a number of friends who have gotten upset with me and called and left messages and said, I've been calling you and you haven't gotten back to me. Well, I'm sorry, but, you know, I'm not going to be available whenever you want me available. So.
Now, Amanda from Northborough and Amanda from Sutton, do you have any interest in getting together and having a cup of coffee or anything social or no?
Oh, we're not that far away.
Give me her home phone number.
Okay, you know what we're going to do? We're going to put you both on hold. We really are. And if you'd like to get together, you should. And then once you've had a meeting, we'd like you to call us back and tell you how it went. Is that a deal?
Got it.
Okay, Amanda, please stay on hold, and our producer will exchange numbers in a second.
Okay.
Thank you, Amanda, as we appreciate it.
Nanda's on the same page as I am. She says, I need my landline to call my cell phone to locate the ladder. I mean, how many times have you done that?
Well, you have a friend with a cell phone.
No, you do it constantly in your own house. I do it every morning before I leave. I call my cell phone on my landline and figure out where it is.
Let's take one more. Jeannie in Brookline, hometown of Marjorie Egan. You are next on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi. I want to point out to Jim, who apparently isn't aware, that not everyone has a car to go out to charge the
cell phone.
That is an excellent point, Jeannie.
You got me on that one, Jeannie.
It's rocket science. And also, I don't know if anyone's mentioned the fact that some people are concerned about the possibility of getting a brain tumor.
No, we didn't mention that.
Yeah, that might be legitimate. I think reasonable people are saying at least alternate ears that you use.
I do that. I alternate the ears because I think I can feel one growing
really?
If I'm on the phone for too long.
Jeannie, thank you for your contributions. I have to say, if we sum up, we're at least at our random evidence from callers and emailers. Overwhelmingly, people want the landline to
they
stick around.
They do, Jim. They do. You're out of step with America.
I apparently am, yes.
But that's okay. Brian McGrory is going to join us next from the Boston Globe. He's going to talk to us about Whitey Bulger and the end of that legendary waterfront restaurant, Anthony's Pier 4. That's next, that conversation on WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
I'm Liz Alessi, I live in Cambridge, and I report here. I've just always been a really curious person. A lot of the more interesting stories that I've found have been things that I just stumble upon because they're issues that I hear people talking about and asking questions about, and I have those questions
too. I
really
think that if patients know better why they're taking their medications, they're more apt to take them.
My job is to do the digging and find out more about that. Liz Alessi, WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
WGBH programs exist because of you and Citizens Bank, presenting sponsor of the 2013 Boston Globe WGBH Summer Arts Weekend, July 26th, 27th, and 28th in Boston's Copley Square. You can learn more at bostonsummerarts.com. And WGBH, too. Go back to ancient times and discover one of the world's most fascinating societies. Don't miss Nova, Building Pharaoh's Chariot at 8, and Secrets of the Dead, Ultimate Tut at 9, Wednesday on WGBH, 2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan joining us on the phone, as he does every Wednesday on Open Mic, is the editor of the Boston Globe, who would be Brian McGrory. Hello, Brian.
Hello, Jim Browdy. Hello, Marjorie. How are you?
I'm great. Brian McGrory. Nice to talk to you once again. So I'm wondering, Brian, you know, we've got this Zohar Sarnaev. He's going to be in court today, the federal courthouse, and the kin families of the survivors. Maybe it's going to be a very dramatic day. But I'm wondering, you're the editor of a big-time newspaper. Is it ever appropriate, is anybody ever going to look back at the police action in Watertown on the Marathon Day, and even the FBI down in Orlando when that young man was shot six or seven times, allegedly, his father says. Are we ever going to look at the police action here? Because some of us, including myself, were a little bit disturbed by it.
Well, I think we have, Marjorie, haven't we? I mean, I thought that we were first with the story that it might have been friendly fire that wounded a police officer over in Watertown. And
Dick Donahue, yeah.
And we have been pressing, as other news organizations have, for the FBI to provide more information on how Todashev died in Orlando or outside of Orlando. It's fairly outrageous that this far into that investigation, we still have no idea what caused police to or FBI agents to open fire on this guy.
There was also, isn't Charlie Savage a Globe alum now with the New York Times?
Yes. What a Pulitzer Prize here for the Globe.
Right. He on those orders, the presidents. What did he win the Pulitzer Prize for? The executive orders. Executive orders. Yeah. He wrote a fabulous piece for the New York Times a couple of weeks ago, in which he demonstrated that every single investigation of any shooting of a suspect either resulted in death or just injury by the FBI, I think from 1993 to 2011, in every single case, 100%, the internal conclusion was the FBI was right in their behavior, which basically, I mean, I don't mean to disparage the FBI more than it deserves to be, but that there's no internal accountability at all.
And what's... You know, as concerning, Jim, is just the lack of information that we are getting in the public to find out what happened there, so that when the FBI does make a determination on whether the shooting was justifiable or not, we're still left in the dark on this thing.
You know, I find this whole secrecy thing very, very disturbing, because it didn't seem to me it was always like this, Brian. I mean, how can the FBI justify not releasing any information at this late date? Do they keep saying the investigation is ongoing? Is that the excuse?
You know, I just realized, can I answer the question? Actually, it's one of your reporters. I don't know if it was Maria Sacchetti or somebody did a piece on exactly this issue. I was thinking
Maria Sacchetti. She compared it to a case out of Michigan, I believe. Yes.
Where essentially, immediately after the FBI did the shooting, there was, I wouldn't say full disclosure, lots of disclosure what went on as compared to the Todashev thing where there's been virtually nothing.
Yeah. I mean, look, when a civilian is killed, authority should err on the side of public disclosure. I mean, come on. It's fairly outrageous to keep us in the dark for as long as they have. And we are getting impatient, but we don't have a lot of alternatives on a case like this.
But, you know, oh, go ahead, Jim.
You know, I don't mean to beat
Marjorie, is it me or is Jim just loaded for bear today?
No, I'm aggravated about so many things.
Not allowed to ask any questions until Jim gets them out of the system,
wow.
Brian.
Well, I know we had this discussion before, and I know you're going to say we discussed this ad nauseum. Yesterday afternoon at NECN, I'm watching our live coverage of the Trayvon Martin case pretty intently. Last night, I'm watching the nonstop CNN coverage of the Trayvon Martin case. And while I'm interested, I'm saying, why am I so into this? And I concluded that one of the reasons I'm so into it is because I won't be able to see Zohar Tsarnaev in court today because it's a federal court with no cameras. I won't be able to see anything, nor have I been able to see anything in Whitey Bulger. And this is what we discussed. What did you say you had done? You had met with the former chief judge of this district, Mark Wolf. What is going on that's going to break this logjam open in terms of no radio, no TV in the courtrooms?
It's out of Washington, and it's really frustrating because you and I have talked about this before, Jim. You know, courts are the place where society goes to get resolution. And for us not to be able to see inside the courtroom in terms of cameras, video, audio, just doesn't make any sense. It just doesn't make any sense at this point. And these decisions are made at the Supreme Court level, and there's no sign that there's going to be change there. I know former federal judge Nancy Gertner had attempted to have a case or two of hers televised, and that didn't work for whatever reason. and there's no sign that there's going to be change.
Well, yeah, let me do one addendum that I may have done when we had this discussion last time. Edgar Herwick, who's one of our colleagues here, did a little research on how the rules are promulgated. And while you're right, the Supreme Court of the U.S. does promulgate them. Apparently, they need approval of the Congress, and they're given pro forma approval more often than not. So if Edgar is right, the people who represent us, the 11 members of Congress, they could lead a crusade, particularly since so much has been happening in the Moakley Courthouse, and they could reject that portion of the rules for the federal courts that prohibit cameras. So maybe we should be focusing on them, to tell you the truth.
All right, so let's focus on them.
Okay, fine, I will.
Thank you. We're going to get back to the theme of secrecy in a couple of minutes, because I am really into it, and a couple of other angles as well, and some of them involving my newspaper and yours, the Boston Globe. But anyway, I want to ask you about the Whitey Bulger trial, because I have been transfixed by this. Any, like, big moments that have transfixed you, Brian? What is the highlight for you so far in the Whitey Bulger trial?
Well, come on. Was there ever a more fascinating day in this trial than yesterday?
No.
My God.
And why did you find it fascinating, Brian? Tell people who may not have been following it as closely as we have.
I mean, I'm just starting to get Shelley Murphy and Kevin Cullen calm down over this thing, because they were in absolute pig heaven. I mean, it was just unbelievable. I mean, to have the exchange that we saw in the kind of august environs of the Moakley Courthouse with, with Kevin Weeks going on about Whitey being a rat and Whitey becoming profane and Kevin Weeks becoming profane back, you know, I mean, expletive you. And then it all ends with Kevin Weeks saying, what are you going to do about it?
I know.
Don't you think the jury's sitting there saying, now, why can't we find Whitey guilty right now and send Kevin Weeks back to prison where he belongs? I'll tell you.
What did he get? He got like 5 years.
Five years. Martirano got 12.
And
what's the
Catherine
point you made about
Greig
Catherine Greig?
He got 8 years, and she was not aiding and abetting any murder. She did aid and abet Whitey in his flight from justice, but it seems a little, of course, she wouldn't cooperate. That's one of her problems. But, you know, this all does raise the question, of course. The supposition at the beginning of this trial was that Whitey Bulger was going to testify. I think that Jay Carney, his attorney, takes a big risk that Whitey will get on the stand and explode a million times under cross-examination.
He may well, but you know what? Whitey might just want his day in court at this point. And it doesn't look like this case is going anywhere good for him, although who really knows what goes on in the minds of jurors. But I wouldn't be shocked if he ended up taking the stand.
Hey, one last obsession in terms of courts with me, Brian, and then we'll move on and I'll try to calm down. The Hernandez case, we're not going to discuss the content of it with you today. If I hear one more reporter in Greater Boston refer to the owner of the Patriots as Mr. Kraft, I am going to have a stroke. Reporters don't even refer to the president as Mr. Obama enough anymore. Do your reporters call him Mr. Kraft? And whether they do or not, does it not bother you as much as it bothers me?
Once we realized that he was not actively bidding on the Globe, we stopped calling him Mr. Kraft.
Good move.
Before that, we alternated between Sir and Mr. Kraft. We're all cleared up on
fine,
that.
I think my liege might be an appropriate title for Bob Kraft. So Brian McGroy, the Boston Globe just got a ruling that supporting you, a lawsuit that you had about another element of secrecy. Tell people about this lawsuit that you guys just won.
Refresh me, because we just won two. So which one are you?
Oh, this is one about the state officials releasing names of people who've received payments from the state to settle
lawsuits,
employment disputes.
Oh, it's outrageous. The state was trying to block us, or the state was trying to not release the names of officials who they had paid what we suspect were very sizable severance payments to. So we went to court, and we got a winning ruling on this thing, because we... this is public money spent on public officials, and it should be in the public domain. It was absolutely outrageous that it wasn't. So we expect we're going to be able to get this information, and we will publish it whenever we have the opportunity.
And the Patrick administration seemed to be the person or the group opposed to this.
They were. I mean, Margie, I suspect you've had the same experience over at the Herald as we have over at the Globe, and that is that this administration has not been the most publicly accessible administration.
It has not.
It's quite the opposite. We find we hit roadblocks in multiple places with the Patrick administration, to the point where it gets frustrating and we have to go to court, as we recently did.
So we have a piece in the Herald this morning. Shauna O'Connell, she's a state rep. She's been very upset about EBT cards and welfare payments and stuff like that. She had to pay $800, and they were clearly doing this to prevent her from getting the records, to get this information about EBT cards. She had to pay for the information. Now, I get if they're saying, okay, it's very expensive to Xerox or copy all these files, or you have to pay copying costs or something like that. But it's the same thing in the state, in the welfare department.
Well, I will tell you, time and time again, and you raise a good point with the money they charge, time and time again, we will go after documents under the Freedom of Information Act, and these are documents that we are entitled to, under state law, under federal law, and they will say, sure, we will give you these documents. It's going to require us giving you 7,000 pages after we work on it for, 180 hours, and the bill for this is going to be $18,000. And it's just eye-rolling at best because they insist on giving you paper copies in an age of computer disks, and the money is meant as a deterrence to us getting the information that we're entitled to.
But is this something that has gotten worse since Deval Patrick became the governor?
Yes, it has.
So what's up?
Oh, wait. And I'm not defending it at all. Believe me, Barack Obama is for total transparency. Excuse me, until he's elected president. Name the politician who was not for full transparency as a candidate, who was against any transparency as an incumbent.
Deval Patrick has been against. I think crazily talking about the privacy rights of the dead Tsarnaev brother.
It's the law, Margaret. I mean, it happens to be the state of the law.
Please.
I agree with you as to what the outcome should be.
They can get their way around it if they want to. Am I right, Brian, or am I right?
Marjorie, I think you are right. Jim, I know just anecdotally, we have hit more roadblocks under this administration than any administration I have covered in my time here at the Globe.
What's the second lawsuit you mentioned that I don't think we knew about? Was that against
second
the
second lawsuit? That was a federal lawsuit regarding Homeland Security and information about people who are being held, in our belief, without cause, in terms of the ICE system. And we won that lawsuit as well.
Hey, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm just going to say, one of the things that drives me crazy about this, this fuels all the people that, that would be hiding from paying their taxes up in these bunkers somewhere in New Hampshire. People, our government officials seem to have forgotten that we're paying for this. We're the taxpayers. It's, for the people, by the people, et cetera. And yet, Deval Patrick, as you said, is one of the politicians that's been extremely secretive.
Yeah, I mean, and let's not look at it. I don't want to overstate it either, Marjorie.
Oh, why not?
Jim raises a good point that, most politicians are in favor of total transparency until they get elected to an office. But there are states that handle this stuff much better than we do here in Massachusetts, Florida being one of them, where documents are much more readily accessible. And for whatever reason here, we just seem to be hitting constant roadblocks in our pursuit of what we're entitled to.
Hey, Deval Patrick's with us for an hour tomorrow. What question should we ask him about this? I knew you'd like that. Go ahead. Just help us out here a little bit.
Jim, you and I will talk off the air.
Okay, fine. Okay. Now, Brian, I read a great story, and it's sort of a sad story. Mark Shanahan, one of your reporters, wrote a great piece just a couple of days ago. Anthony's Pier 4 will close for good in August, sort of this iconic restaurant. And what I then went and did was I was wondering, because I've only eaten there a couple of times, and I wasn't there in sort of the heyday. I was looking for a great restaurant review. Can I read you from a restaurant review of Anthony's? I'd love your reaction to it.
Yes, yes.
Back before there were restaurants called Clio, or even Olives and Hammersley's, back before salmon was served in medallions and chickens were given free range, back before the Red Sox nearly realized their impossible dream, a fish house opened called Anthony's Pier 4. I'm not done yet. It had an air of big city elegance. Here's my favorite paragraph. Those were the days. The pretty popover girls swept through the dining room, plucking their steaming goods from a wicker basket. You're listening, right? Frank Sinatra crooned from the sound system before it occurred to anyone he would ever actually grow old. Who knew fish was healthy and who even cared? Certainly not the chain-smoking diners. These restaurants were simply the place to be. What do you think of that review, by the way?
You know, we don't have writing like that in newspapers anymore, do we? We don't have writing of that.
What, you get an extra $100 you weren't the restaurant. This is 1998, Brian McGrory in the Boston Globe. Were you a restaurant reviewer?
That might have been the best assignment I ever had. I was the White House reporter at the time.
No, is that true?
I was a White House reporter. This God's honest truth here. I was a White House reporter, and our restaurant critic at the time took a leave of absence. I forget what she was doing, but she was gone for about 3 months or 6 months, and the editor of the Globe at the time, Matt Storen, called me in Washington and said, "We have spent probably tens of thousands of dollars on you dining out all over the world. I want you to come up to Boston and review restaurants for a couple of months." So I would fly up every couple of weekends, go to places like Anthony's Pier 4, Grill 23, write reviews, and fly back and cover Bill Clinton.
Oh, my goodness. What a deal that is. That's spectacular. But you know something? I'm going to – not that I've been there lately. I haven't, but
– We were there with some listeners from our former radio show a year or two ago.
We were there at Anthony's Pier 4. I have a great nostalgia, as much of Boston does. I mean, I grew up in Fall River. It was a big deal. We'd drive out to Boston to go to Anthony's Pier 4, and you look out at the beautiful view of the waterfront, and you're right. The popover girls, as you point out, they did get a little older over the years. But it was – and all the pictures of Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton.
I actually love that.
You know, it's sad.
I think I had a line in that review further in, if I'm remembering right. And Jim, I know you didn't tell me it was wonderfully written or anything.
No,
but
actually,
sure
I love
to.
It, but go ahead. I loved it.
About the popover girls wearing orthopedic shoes later on.
Yeah, they get older, but it's a beautiful thing. Their whole lives were spent at Anthony's Pier 4 being waitresses, right?
If you get a chance, go into the archives and pull out a Jack Thomas takeout on Anthony's Pier 4. He did a long, long story on Anthony's.
One of the greatest writers who has ever graced newspapers in this
town. It was phenomenal. It was just plain phenomenal.
And by the way, where do you go for Cheese Whiz now? I mean, that's the other problem.
Well, you know what else? You had those porches. I'm not sure if Anthony's did, but Jimmy's Harborside, which closed a few years ago, too, and Anthony's, of course, is closing in August. Jimmy's Harborside had that great back porch, Brian. Remember that?
Yeah, Anthony's did, too. Anthony's
okay, you could go out and sit on the back porch and be right there in the harbor and with your Cheese Whiz, and I'm very nostalgic about its being gone.
Popovers were great.
It will be.
Popovers were terrible.
Although, you know, it's still hanging in down there. Have you been down to the No Name?
I love the No Name.
Yeah.
Not been there in years either.
It's also still pretty cheap, by the way.
Well, everybody's going to the Legal Seafoods bar. You know, I mean, the Legal Seafoods, you go to there, it's packed. It's got three floors.
It's also totally
rooftop.
Beautiful.
It is.
It's really beautiful.
Everybody in the rooftop is 21.
Okay, now, Brian, one last thing we wanted to broach with you. You know, you don't write the headlines in the Globe, do you?
I do not. Okay. No, I try every once in a while. I'm a terrible headline writer.
Well, you know, I hesitate to criticize you because you're kind enough to come on every single Wednesday with us. There was a headline.
Jim, you spent half your life criticizing. Get over it.
But it's only half. The story in the New York Daily News, which announced the entry of Eliot Spitzer into the race for city controller in New York City, had a headline that I'm saying it's not in the Herald, it's not even in the Globe. Tell me what you think. The headline was, "Here we hoe again." What do you think about that?
I am embarrassed that we didn't think of that.
By the way, the beauty, I know you can't editorialize much anymore. When you heard that Spitzer, who was a great attorney general, Marjorie and I agree on that, and obviously had his problems when he became governor. Spitzer is running for controller of the city of New York. Anthony Weiner is tied for the lead with Christina Quinn for the mayoral thing. What do you say to yourself as you're sitting in your chair over there on Mars?
I mean, it's so great. It's so great. These are two great, great stories. There is a maybe beginning with Bill Clinton, maybe before, there is a somewhat of a public acceptance of infidelities or sexual peccadilloes among politicians by the public. And we're seeing that play out a little bit in New York. I don't know if these two guys will win. I don't know if they'll lose. But I don't know. It's just plain a really interesting human story.
Spitzer, to me, is sort of a run-of-the-mill picadillo, even though the image of the black socks, which he apparently kept on when he was having sex with the call girl. Weiner is another frontier, it seems to me. You know, the tweeting pictures of yourself to women you don't even know or hardly know, and that seems a little bit odder to me, and he's so unattractive when you look at him, but everybody says he's an unbelievably great campaigner.
Who, according to the New York Times analysis, did not achieve any of the five things that he says he achieved in his opening video.
But he's New York. There's something very New York about Anthony Weiner, don't you think?
There is something New York about him, but boy, what he did was pretty twisted.
Very twisted.
Yeah. Hey, Brian, before you go away, we had Shannon O'Brien here, who obviously ran for governor about a decade ago against Mitt Romney. One of us asked her the question, if a woman had done what Anthony Weiner, Elliot Spitzer, Mark Sanford, go down the list, had done, is there any chance that she could ever run for and win elective office again?
What did she say?
She said not a chance in hell, and Marjorie agrees with her. How about you?
I don't know. I'd have to think that through. You may well be right. You may well be right. Although, just speaking of women, and this is partly intended to deflect the question, Marjorie, you had a terrific column on Teresa Hines the other day ago.
Thank you very much.
I remember years ago when Kerry got engaged to her, we sent a reporter up, and the reporter happened to be me.
Oh, I was there, too. We went in shifts.
Did we do that?
Yes,
remember, they
to
were
his
in,
law
like,
office.
His, they
his
were
law
in the Senate
office,
office downtown.
The Senate office, excuse me.
I could not get enough of her. Like, she
me too.
Was mesmerizing. Hey. And I often wondered what she saw in him, but I say that jokingly.
Of course, I'm glad you did a caveat.
Brian,
there.
You know something? It's funny because when I was writing that column, I was saying to myself, I didn't see what she saw in him, but I got what he saw in her. I left out the first part because he is. You've probably dined with him a couple of times. I had lunch with John Kerry one time on the waterfront. He had a glass of wine. I had a glass of wine. At the time, he was dating Morgan Fairchild, and I thought, what does Morgan Fairchild see in this man that
he's a handsome guy and he's a personable guy. You don't think so?
I don't think
Ryan's
you would think.
I'm
a female. I didn't get the sort of magnetism coming from John Kerry.
Enough, John Kerry. Brian,
one would expect.
I have one last question for you. Ready for this?
Go ahead.
Still, who are we to take exception with stability, to look askance at tradition? More important, who are we to turn our noses up at the complimentary cheese whiz-like spread and Ritz crackers served at both establishments? What's the answer to that question, Brian? Who are we to turn our noses up at that?
This is...
who are we? I mean, answer the question. Come on. Don't dilly-dally.
Marjorie, help me out here, for God's
sake.
I
love cheese whiz,
okay,
Brian. You know,
in that
tradition.
Jack Thomas story that I referenced before, he asked Anthony point blank, do you put the unused cheese whiz back in the bin and reuse it with other people? And Anthony denied up and down that was ever done.
By the way, and Jack Thomas, not that he didn't write a million great stories, also did the single greatest interview with Mitt Romney and Ann Romney
Has
probably ever been published.
Yeah.
The West Roxbury.
Oh, my God.
Yes, Jack Thomas is a genius. I am so fond of his writing. I studied it for years.
Hey, Brian, good to talk to you. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you next Wednesday.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Marjorie.
Thank you, Brian. Great to talk to you.
Coming up in a couple of seconds, a solution, potentially, to crushing student debt. It's coming to us from Oregon. Don't go away.
New England fishermen have a storied history making a living off the bounty of cod in the waters off of Cape Cod. But with depleted fisheries, stricter regulations, and a growing number of fish-loving seals, will it be the fishermen who become the endangered species? I'm Bob See. Join WGBH News for focus coverage on the future of New England fisheries all this week on WGBH's All Things Considered.
This program is made possible thanks to you. An old Sturbridge village celebrating Fire and Ice Day, July 20th. An old-time fireman's muster with antique fire engines, bucket brigades, and handmade ice cream using early New England recipes. Details at osv.org. And M. Steinert & Sons, introducing customers to the joys of playing music. New England's source for Steinway and other fine pianos for more than 150 years. With showrooms in Boston and at the Natick Mall. msteinert.com.
You're listening to Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan on Boston Public Radio. No surprise to you, student loan debt is up. I think it's expected to exceed $1 trillion by the end of the year. Interest on some student loans doubled thanks to a do-nothing Congress on July 1. Joining us from Portland, Oregon to talk about a do-something state legislature, which is confronting in bipartisan fashion crushing student debt, is Barbara Dudley. She's a professor with Portland State University's College of Urban and Public Affairs. Professor Dudley, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So tell us, Professor, what is this bill out in Oregon, and how would it help kids and their parents who are drowning in all this debt?
What the bill is, and just to give it some context, the bill was developed by students of mine in a class that I taught with another professor on student debt. And what it does is it provides for students to be able to go to public university or community college tuition-free, and then they commit to paying after they're done. They commit to paying a fixed percentage of their income for a fixed number of years.
And my understanding is, but the percentage, Barbara Dudley, just so I'm clear, the percentage is based upon how much you're making in those subsequent years, right? It's sort of a progressive income tax sort of thing.
It's a percentage of your income. That's exactly right.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say the way in which we decided on the percentages that we were proposing was based on average earnings of Oregon students coming out of public universities and community colleges.
And did I read correctly in the New York Times the other day about this, Barbara Dudley, that you say your students came up with this concept and then it went from there to legislature, bipartisan? I think every person who was in attendance voted for it. Was there a space of only a year between the time, the genesis of this idea and its unanimous passage by the legislature?
Not even a year.
And so
the class was in the fall, and it passed on July 1st. That finally, it passed its final house at the Senate.
That's amazing. So what does this mean for kids in Oregon now? When can they begin taking advantage of this great deal?
Don't jump ahead too fast. What the bill provides for is for the Higher Education Coordinating Committee, which is like our Board of Regents, you know, it's the board that governs all the public universities and colleges, to come up with a pilot project. So it's not going to go into effect for all students at all universities right away. They're to design a pilot program to test it out. And because, as you can imagine, this will require a certain amount of upfront funding, quite a bit amount of upfront funding, we have to pass first a constitutional amendment, which will be on the 2014 ballot, to allow the treasurer to issue bonds for something other than physical infrastructure, so as to create this higher ed fund, which will provide the upfront funding, and then the students will pay back into that fund.
Hey, Barbara Dudley, has the governor signed this thing yet, or is that still pending? And what's the prospect? What's the expectation of what he does?
I have no reason to think he won't sign it.
You know, we talked to the Republican candidate for governor last time around here yesterday, Charlie Baker, who I think it's fair to say, Marjorie, loved the idea. The governor,
yes.
Deval Patrick, is with us tomorrow. We're going to ask him about it
uh-huh.
as well. Is this being talked about? I don't mean to put the cart before the proverbial horse. Are you getting contacts from legislators, professors,
yes.
organizations around the country saying, can
yes.
we use this model back home? So,
yeah.
So people are getting excited about this, yes?
People are getting excited. I mean, I think everybody would agree that the best thing that could happen would be for some kind of federal action that would help people who have currently existing debt. Because
that'll be happening soon. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Right, exactly. No one's holding their breath. So we looked around what could be done on a state level that would give some immediate relief to our students here. And, you know, we're not saying it's going to fix everybody's problems for all time, but it certainly is a very good partial solution.
You know, Professor, when you get to talking about constitutional amendments and stuff, people get very nervous. What do you think are the prospects of this? I mean, I know we had the unanimous approval in the legislature, but what do you think are the prospects of the bills finally getting to that pilot program?
Oh, I think they're pretty good. The constitutional amendment is simply to expand the bonding, the ability of the treasurer to issue bonds. And I think when people hear about it and realize it will be creating a higher ed fund that will be self-sufficient, that they're going to love it.
Maybe you're just nicer out there in Oregon, because I think in Massachusetts, lots of people would be saying, well, what about these deadbeat kids? Suppose they don't pay us back. And suppose they don't pay their loans back.
Well, what's the difference?
I think that those are the individual citizens of Oregon might be more concerned if they get federal loans just spread across all the 50 states. I mean,
well, the mechanism for people paying back has to be created, and there's one of two ways that's going to happen. Either, and this I think would require more states being interested in it, but the best way would be for it to be deducted from your paycheck, you know, as part of like the way the IRS collects money now for Social Security or Medicare, whatever. But barring that, it's an enforceable contract.
Barbara Dudley, does this in any way, I mean, it deals with one part of the problem, I think, in a brilliant and simple way. Does it deal at all with what I think everybody agrees are the totally obscene underlying costs? Forget how you pay for them, just the cost of going to both private and public institutions?
No, it does not. I mean, part of the problem here is that we have to be sure that this plan doesn't give the state some kind of license to further decrease its contribution to higher education.
Mm-hmm.
This assumes that the state's contribution, the general fund contribution, will continue to be the same and hopefully grow. And in fact, they were able to grow it a bit in this session of the legislature. I mean, Oregon, like every other state, has been facing a really serious recession, thank you, Wall Street. And as a result of that, you know, they have been unable to fully fund K through 12, never mind increase their contribution to higher ed. So the students have been picking up the difference, and that has to stop. But, you know, we can only do so much with one bill.
We're talking with Barbara Dudley, professor with Portland State University's College of Urban and Public Affairs, and her students in her class came up with this great idea about basically going to school tuition-free and then paying back on the other end a percentage of your salary. You know, you mentioned, Barbara, this pilot program. I mean, are we talking, again, years where the pilot program would have to go on for 5 or 10 years so people could be assured that the kids were paying this money back, or young adults at that point, or their parents, or what?
Well, I don't – I'm not concerned about the will the students pay it back. There has to be a mechanism in place for enforcing it, but nobody – I mean, this is not going to be just on the honor system. We're not that naive. So there will be an enforcement mechanism. That part I'm not worried about. The thing that is a greater concern is coming up with the upfront funding.
Right.
Even if the governor, you know, when the governor gets his authority to issue these bonds, you know, if you were to cover all students in the state of Oregon until the fund became self-sufficient, you'd be talking billions of dollars. So we're starting on a smaller scale so that we can start building up the fund and expanding it in that way.
Hey, Barbara.
So how long will that take? I don't know.
Barbara Dudley, what's the argument against this? I know that's not your role, but I'm trying to think as I'm sitting here. What do people say who didn't
what's
like
this? What's wrong with it?
Yeah.
Well, there are two arguments against it. One is that higher education should be free, and that it should be fully funded by the public, as it were, by the taxpayer, and be seen as a public good, and that we're just encouraging further shifting of the cost to students.
Okay, what's the other one?
So the obvious response to that is we're not shifting it any further than it's already shifted. But the other one is that it doesn't cover all the costs that a student incurs when they go to college, and therefore they may still go into debt, which is true. I mean, if a student, you know, the students who go to Portland State, most of them are working, you know, at jobs often 40 hours a week and sometimes more to help pay for college.
Sure.
That's paying their room and board. So their costs are really tuition. Textbooks we're not taking into account. That's another issue. But so, yes, will they still incur some debt? Probably so. Maybe not if they're, you know, if they can land a good enough job while they're in school.
You know, I think maybe the people of Oregon are more trusting. We just got an email from Art from West Bridgewater. He says, and when the percentage of the students' earnings doesn't meet expenses at the colleges, the taxpayers will have to pick up the tab.
No, they can't fix it. Hey, Barbara Dudley, a couple of quick things. One, if people want more information about this, how do they contact you, or what website? Where do they go to get more information?
They could go to the Working Families Party website. That, I have failed to mention, was one of the main reasons we were able to get this through, is the Working Families Party, of which I am a member, was helping to lobby it in the legislature, which meant it wasn't a Democrat or Republican bill. It was Working Families Party.
What's the website for that?
That is OregonWFP.org.
Hey, before you go away, as I've said your name about 18 times in the last 10 minutes, did you ever work in New York City?
Oh, you bet.
You're not the Barbara Dudley who worked for the National Lawyers Guild, are you?
I most certainly am.
I was head of the national union that represented legal services lawyers around the country, and I knew you quite well. You're the same Barbara Dudley.
I am indeed.
Unlike me, you've actually made something of yourself, Barbara. Hey, Barbara, congratulations. It's great to talk to you after 20-some years or 30 years.
Yeah.
This is unbelievable.
And yes, it's been a long path from there to here.
Well, you've done great work. This is terrific. We're excited, and we're excited to talk to the governor about it tomorrow at noon. We'll let you know how it goes. Barbara Dudley, thanks so much for your time.
You bet. My pleasure.
Barbara Dudley is a professor with Portland State University's College of Urban and Public Affairs and also a buddy of Jim back when he was practicing law in the South Bronx. Can money buy happiness? That is up for debate. But research says how you could spend that money, whether you do it in advance or whether you do it while, whether you do it after you've made the purchase, can make you happier. That's next on 89.7 WGBH.
The trial of George Zimmerman, the man who shot and killed the unarmed teenager Trayvon Martin, has captivated the attention of much of the country. As the trial wraps up, we'll take an in-depth look at the proceedings and the provocative debates the trial has sparked across the country. That's next time on Tell Me More from NPR News.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Newbridge on the Charles in Dedham. This active senior community in a natural setting offers something for everyone. You can find out what many seniors have already discovered at experiencenewbridge.org. And Harvard Extension School, online certificate in strategic management. Registration begins July 29th. More information available at extension.harvard.edu. That's extension.harvard.edu.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. So should you pay in advance for that trip to Paris, or should you put it on the credit card? And will your choice have an impact on your enjoyment of the Eiffel Tower? Here to discuss, actually, this is the title of his op-ed, recent op-ed in the New York Times, Happier Spending and More, is Michael Norton. He's an associate professor at Harvard Business School, co-author of the new book, Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. Michael, it's good to see you again.
Thanks for having me back.
Hi, Michael. So what's the answer? If you're lucky enough to be going to Paris and you pay for your trip and you pay for your tours all in advance, will you be happier Paris?
You will be way happier. And you'll be happy in Paris no matter what, probably, because Paris is great. But you'll be way happier if you pay in advance, because when you pay in advance, especially if you pay way in advance, by the time you get there, you forgot that you paid. And every single second of the trip will feel free. Every meal, every hotel, every cab, everything, if you paid for it in advance, you'll be happier because you won't feel like it's coming out of your pocket.
How do you know this, by the way? We were joking with you before when Michael first came in during the break, and we said, by the way, both of us totally agree with you. And what'd you say? That's good because we made it all up. You didn't make it all up. How do you know? I mean, we both do agree. How do you know this to be true?
So there's been actually a fair amount of research on what makes experiences better or worse. And it turns out that when you are paying for things in the moment, there's even a term for it. It's called the pain of paying. And we all know that feeling of forking out cash, and it feels as though something's being – even if you're getting an amazing thing in return,
right,
you have that pain of paying that kind of ruins the experience. And if you pay way in advance, it still hurts when you paid, but now you separated the pain of paying from the enjoyment of the thing, and that's going to make the thing
so
way
the
better.
Worst, let's grade these if I get this correctly. The worst is to essentially put it on your credit card and pay for it later. The best is the other extreme, which is to pay for it well in advance. But the alternative, which is also still pretty good, is right before you do it, you pay for it, and at least it's done before you enjoy the CD player or the trip or the whatever it is. Is that a fair statement?
That's exactly right, because one of the worst things for happiness is debt. So if you're thinking about what you owe in general, you're going to be unhappy. And if you're thinking about what you owe as you're enjoying the CD player or as you're eating the meal, it's going to hurt. One of the examples we often use is, imagine you ate a meal and every bite you took, you had to pay for. It would completely ruin the entire meal. And that's the psychology underlying it, is that if you have to pay while you're doing it, it's going to be really a bad experience. See if you can move it back a little bit and you'll be a lot happier.
We're talking to Michael Norton. His number is 877. Our number is 877-301-8970. Do you agree with his research and conclusion? Marjorie and I do. I mean, the credit card, I think, is both the best and the worst invention of all time. And I would argue the best invention, which I think comports with your notion here. The debit card was the most brilliant thing that has happened probably in the last 30 years. Am I right about that or am I wrong?
I don't know, the iPod and the iPad are pretty cool.
Yeah, that's true.
In terms of one's spending. I mean, the bottom line is you can't spend what you don't have.
Well, wait a minute, though. I think you feel much worse paying with cash than you do paying with a debit card. So I think that there's part of that thing going on there with you could get much more trouble. I mean, if somebody asked you to hand over $50 in cash, that's $5, $10 bills as opposed to handing them your little debit card, right?
That's right. And the beauty of credit cards was exactly that you didn't have to feel like you were paying in the moment because you're just swiping something and who knows where the money's coming from. The problem with credit cards, as you're saying, is, well, then you end up really in debt. And debit cards are an interesting middle ground where they're kind of a commitment device where it takes away a little bit of the pain, but you can't overspend like crazy because it's going to say you don't have enough money to do that.
Right.
You know, the scientific connection to this. I'm reading the piece you wrote with Elizabeth Dunn in the New York Times on June 22nd, Happier Spending. Paying high prices for goods and services activates the region of the brain associated with the anticipation of actual physical pain. So it's not just it's a physical reaction one has to the spending. Is that so?
That's right. And I think if you think about times when you've had to write a check for an enormous amount of money, like your kid's college tuition, for example, I think it does feel actually physically painful. It's a little bit like someone smacking you across the face. And the research shows that it is a little bit like someone smacking you across the face.
And it's terribly anxiety-producing. I think that's the thing with going somewhere, a trip on a credit card, because I've done both, paid in advance and then go. And you are thinking, oh, my God, this is another meal that's going to cost me $200. Oh, my God, how much is it going to cost for me to take the little boat that goes around the if you're in France, down the river there? I mean, it's all that anxiety. But Amazon.com, because we all order stuff on Amazon.com. I know exactly what you're talking about. If you order a book or you order clothes or you order whatever and you pay it in advance, even if it is with a debit card, you've paid for it. You've accounted for that. Then you have like a week of anticipating its arrival. And when it gets there, it's totally disassociated from having to pay for it, right?
Some people describe prepaying for things on Amazon and getting them a week later as a gift to yourself. And I think that's right. It feels like somebody in the past.
Yes.
Or maybe it was me. Maybe it was somebody else. But somebody gave me a gift today, and it feels completely free because I paid for it so long ago. And you're also right that week of waiting, we tend to think of a waiting as bad, you know, that it's hard to wait for things. But a week of anticipating things can be fantastic. You're really looking forward to it coming. And in fact, there's some cool research that shows that people often experience the biggest spike in their happiness the week before their vacation.
Is the anticipation of it.
Exactly. And after their vacation, they're not as happy as they
were
before
their
vacation. You
know why that is? Because they spend 25 hours driving back from Provincetown to Boston. Our number is 877-301-8970. Marjorie, I, who have no research basis, and Michael Norton, who does, believe in this notion. If you pay up front, I know it's not the term of art. What do you call it? Some pain thing? What was the expression you used a minute ago?
The pain of paying.
The pain of paying. If you experience the pain of paying up front, you're going to enjoy the experience for which you paid far greater. Are you buying that, so to speak? 877-301-8970.
You know, I have this rather ridiculous example, but it just shows how right you are about this. Because they don't sell this at CVS anymore, Vaseline Petroleum Cream. It's a cream, it's, you know, for your skin. Mm-hmm. they stopped selling it. So now I have to order it online, and I order it from Amazon. And I bought 12 of them, and I got ripped off on the shipping costs, but I've already paid that, and I'm so excited. Will my petroleum jelly cream come today or come tomorrow or come on Friday? It's ridiculous. It's like cream for your skin.
It's pathetic, isn't it, Michael? I mean, isn't that what your reaction is to this?
I am so excited about the arrival of my petroleum jelly cream.
It's like Santa every day, basically.
Exactly.
Just, yeah.
You know, we asked you last time you were here, before we get to the goals, do you actually live this stuff that you preach here? Do you do it? I mean, do you put stuff on credit cards? Are you all like a paying up front or whatever that thing was kind of guy?
I'm a paying up front guy. Now, I will say, of course, sometimes when cash is tight, there are perfectly good reasons to use your credit card and go into debt. You know, medical expenses come up and things like that. But if you can, it's always better to pay up front, both for your happiness, as we talked about, but also for your financial health.
I have another good one. Here's another good one before we get to the calls. Someone gets into Harvard, which is where you teach, and they're quite pleased about this. Will they enjoy...
Are you trying to get into Harvard?
I actually did try to get into Harvard. It's a little late, and it didn't work out so well. If you pay up front, well, the same rule applies, what I'm basically saying. Will you enjoy your college experience more? You, the kid, or the parent, I guess, as well, will they enjoy the kid's experience more if they're able to pay for this thing up front, as opposed to, which almost nobody can, but if they could, as opposed to paying it off in the next decade or whatever it is?
You know, there is something to be said for if everything comes free to you, you don't appreciate it as much. You know, so the example of a parent paying for everything for their kid.
Oh, that's a good point, yeah.
And the kid never has to work to earn anything. That's a whole other problem, I think, that people run into. And there it can be the case that if everything's free, nothing feels valuable to you. So some sweat equity, for sure, can be good. But yeah, in general, if you look at it, if you think about if you're paying for every single class and you had to turn over money at the end of every single lecture, you'd probably have a harder time getting immersed in the lecture because you'd be thinking about the bill coming at the end.
You know what the variation on this theme is? It's not about advance. You know, a lot of people who have trouble with the level of the income tax in this country say if we ended withholding in this country, you know, that this amount automatically comes out of your check, so you really don't feel the pain. If every 2 weeks when you get paid, you had to write a check to the federal government, there'd be a revolution,
yeah.
Which is really a variation on your theme, is it not?
Absolutely. And in some European countries, you don't really, your actual salary isn't salient, your take-home salary is.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas here, your actual salary yeah. is very salient and not your take-home salary. It really changes the psychology of taxes.
Let's take some calls here. Our number is 877-301-8970.
Ariel from Boston. What do you think about Michael's theory, Ariel?
I am really intrigued by it, actually. When he mentioned the part about the Amazon waiting period
yep.
and after you pay for it and everything, the first thing I thought of actually was my prom, which was a few years ago now. But just the anticipation of getting ready and having all of that kind of pay off and get that gift of that. And then there's the letdown afterwards.
Yeah, they never quite live up to the expectations. But that's a great example, is it not, Michael?
Absolutely. I think, you know, these special events that we are waiting for and then they happen later, just that anticipation period is so exciting. And the holidays are this, you know, Hanukkah and Christmas is kids dying with anticipation the night before, wondering what they're going to get the next day. Then, as we all know, they end up playing with the box instead yeah. of the toy. And that really shows you how good the anticipation is and how boring the thing actually is when it happens.
Ariel, do you continue to experience this kind of thing in your post-prom life?
Oh, definitely. I find that the online shopping is actually a great way to feel about that because, like you said, you pay it, you get it out of the way, and then you do have this great thing of, oh, I'm going to get something for myself. And it's coming and it's for me and it's all paid for. And I find that is actually what makes the online shopping really, really addictive.
Ariel, yeah. Thanks so much. I'm sorry about the prom, but thank you so much for the, you know, I'm thinking as Ariel's speaking and as you're speaking, as Marjorie's speaking, it's true. When you do order something online, as you're about to get home every day, you say to yourself, is the package going to be there?
I know.
Whether it's the Vaseline, whatever the
petroleum
hell it is
cream.
You're buying, whatever it is. Or it's, I mean, it is amazing that the brain works that way. You look with great satisfaction at these comments. Let's go to Framingham where Nancy's on with Michael Norton from Harvard. Welcome, Nancy.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
When you go abroad, the first time, as I did, go with a group, with a tour operator. If there's any problems, of which there was one on the return flight to Boston from Shannon Airport, the tour operator will figure it all out, and not you, the tourist. So have fun. Go to France. Go to Paris. Have the time of your life. Speak French, the way to a Frenchman's heart, is through his language.
Thank you. Couldn't agree with some of that more there, Nancy. Thank you.
How about Alicia from Boston? What do you think, Alicia?
Hi. I was really excited by this discussion because I was thinking about healthcare, where there's been a lot of discussion about the charge master, which is very intimidating. You get bills after the fact.
This is
and
great.
It's a very unpleasant experience. But if you could get bills in advance, as you were suggesting earlier, and maybe even as like an a la carte service, it could even make the experience more positive.
This is brilliant. That is a brilliant question. Have you thought about that, Michael?
Yeah, we have been thinking a little bit about it. So listeners may be aware that there's some controversy about healthcare in the United States right now. And the idea of whether it's a fee or a tax or a mandate or all of these terms, fee, tax, and mandate are all very negative terms. And they imply that healthcare is a negative sort of event. And you could think about making it instead like a purchase where you're buying something that's good. And then good things can happen to you as a result of that. And the idea of prepaying actually is very interesting to think about.
Is anybody talking about that at all in the healthcare industry?
Prepaying is difficult, of course, because you can have people who, when they see the size of the bill, they won't get the care they need. So there's a
different insurance policy.
Exactly.
But aren't we, I mean, if you have good insurance, which I know is almost an oxymoron for a lot of people, you are sort of paying in advance. When you go to that doctor and you do the copay or whatever it is, you pay the $10, the $20, whatever, and you pray that your insurance company is actually going to pay the difference. Isn't that a variation on Alicia's theme? In theory, at least?
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting idea.
But then you're worried that they're not going to pay, which undermines the whole thing. Alicia, great call. Thanks.
We're talking with Michael Norton, the author of Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending, about the theory that not only does debt make us unhappy, but paying for things in advance and the anticipation of those things that you've already paid for make us much more happy. You mentioned in your piece, Michael, something about Square Wallet. What, please, is Square Wallet?
Square Wallet is an app that you can install on your phone. It's a brilliant app where basically to pay for anything in the world, you just walk up into the store, hold your phone up, and it does everything for you. So it's even faster than a credit card. There's not even a swipe. It's just hold it up and show it, and then you're on your way. And it's a brilliant technology, of course, because it makes things faster. But again, it hides the pain of paying. So if all you're doing is waving your phone around, it just feels like everything is free, and you just run through the store buying everything with your phone. And then a week later, you realize you spent $4,000.
Yeah.
So again, these technologies, just like credit cards, you know, 30, 40 years ago, made a big difference for convenience. They can have these costs for our happiness that we're not often thinking of when we get them.
How old is the debit card? Was it 20 years old? 25,
something like that, probably.
25 years old? I mean, it is a brilliant thing. 877-301-8970.
Jackie from Waltham. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you very much. I love your show.
Thank you.
I just have a statement, not a question. When my sister was very little, she had once, beyond my father's and mother's means, and what she would rationalize is, Daddy, a money? You don't have to pay for it. Just charge it.
That is exactly what the thinking was, right? That's a great line, Jackie.
Does she still behave that way?
Hey, Jackie, thank you for the call. But that is the theory. Isn't that the theory? You're not paying, right?
That's right.
You put it off till another day.
And people have no idea. I mean, I remember when I was, first got out of college and I first had a credit card. I was like ridiculous. It kind of didn't dawn on me that I was going to get this huge bill at the end of the month and I was going to have to pay for all this stuff. It's weird how, an otherwise rational person can be duped into thinking things are free.
That's right. In fact, many colleges are now trying to offer in the first month or so of college for new students, do you know how finance works, basically? Do you realize that a credit card comes with a bill later? Because often they had a credit card in high school. And then
their parents
pay the bill,
right.
And they never learn that the swiping has anything to do with actual money coming out of your bank.
Or they think that you can go to the bank machine and take out thousands and thousands of dollars. It just keeps coming right out of the machine.
It does, doesn't it? I mean, sorry. So, Michael, give three, based on this discussion, if people want the takeaway to be two or three pieces of advice in terms of what's the title of your piece of happier spending. Give them three rules of happier spending.
So one of the things to think about is everything in the world right now encourages us to consume things right away and pay for them way later. So credit cards allow us to pay for things later. Consuming now, you can go on iTunes and get the book or the CD or the song right now. And that's all well and good, but it's bad for happiness. So instead of
both things are
bad for happiness. So consuming now means you don't get that anticipation and that excitement that we talked about. And paying later means you're often in debt. So we tell people to flip it basically. So pay now and consume later. Pay as early as you can. You get the anticipation period. You don't go into debt. And then when you're on the experience, it just feels free and it feels amazing.
That's a bumper sticker or something. Is it not? Pay now, consume later. So is anybody, I remember last time you were here a month ago or something, I'm saying to myself, these are brilliant ideas. Anybody doing this? Is behavior, is there any indication, I know your book is relatively new, but is there any indication that people are moving to a pay now, consume later thing thoughtfully, as opposed to that we don't, when we go to Amazon, we don't do it because we say, boy, is this going to be great? We have to wait a week and there'll be great interest, but we do it because that's how we do it. Is anybody thinking their way to this position besides you?
A little bit, yes. Yeah. So certainly the rise of credit cards, debit cards suggests that consumers have, because you can still get a credit card, but often people are switching to debit cards a little bit because they know they need to help themselves not overspend, and paying now will help.
How many credit cards in your wallet before we go?
50.
Michael Norton, from an associate professor at Harvard Business School and co-author of the new book, Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. Thanks again. It was great to see you.
Thank you.
Michael Norton. That's it for another edition of Boston Public Radio. We'll hope you tune in tomorrow at noon. The governor will be in studio noon to one to take your phone calls, your emails. In fact, you could start emailing him now if you want. What's the email, Marjorie? BPR.
The email is bpr@wgbh.org.
Exactly. And you can follow us on Twitter at BOS Public Radio, me at Jim Browdy, Marjorie at Marjorie Egan. That's it for today. Our show is a production of WGBH Radio. I am Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan.
Have a great day.